Eye on Careers, in association with Laymoon.com. Refresh your career with jobs, courses, and events.
Hello and welcome to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. And this episode, we have a very exciting guest, a man who's truly followed his passions. He's the founder of CD Baby, an online independent music website, which had revenues of over $100 million US, which he sold for $22 million. A self-made millionaire, a musician, a humanitarian. This is the story of Derek Sivers. Derek, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Thanks, Shane. Thanks for having me.
It's pretty exciting because how connected we are in the world today. I mean, I was watching your videos on YouTube, and then I saw you had posted your email address. So I shot you an email figuring that you'd probably get 6 million emails a day because I think your YouTube videos have over 5 million views. And you responded, and here we are chatting now. It's amazing.
What I think is funny is I think it's funny when people email me saying things like, oh, I'm sure you're really busy, and I doubt I'll even hear back from you, but... And then they say something, and I laugh, and I think that's kind of cute, and of course I answer my own email. But on the other hand, I read all of these books, and I worship the authors, and I just realized, wow, I've never emailed any of the authors of the books I love because... I just assume they're too busy to hear from me. So, yeah, okay, I get it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think now, you know, from a career development perspective, whether you're a musician or you're a banker or you're a lawyer, you could really look in the world and say, okay, who's the top corporate lawyer? Who's the top real estate agent? Or who's the top whatever? You can reach out to them and you can start sharing information about, you know, getting to the next level or getting insights. And I think that's what I loved about your videos, that really... very simple, very hilarious, and very insightful into, you know, what is leadership, this epic question that, you know, people can wrestle with, academics, pundits, and industrialists wrestle with on a daily basis. And you had this video online that's called Leadership Lessons from the Dancing Guy, I think, which is for for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's basically a university party where there's somebody who has obviously consumed a few beverages, we would assume, and is dancing in a fairly ridiculous way. And as you describe in the video, is a lone nut until the first follower comes along and then the second follower. And then within a short period of time, there's about 150 plus people dancing. And, you know, this guy has gotten everybody up and moving. But was it really him or was it the first follower? Which was quite interesting. Concept.
Right. I think it's one that most people assume, of course, that we give so much attention to the leader, the person who started something, the founder, but it's kind of overlooking the fact that a founder is just a loner, is a lone nut, and it's really, if you watch carefully, it really is that the first couple people that join in are the one that show others how to follow and really turn it from a lone nut into a real movement.
And I think if you take this kind of, you know, university party, and it really grafts on well to corporate life, in that so many times senior executives or a new CEO or a new senior leader comes in and he doesn't get the right support or she doesn't get the right support to rally around an idea. And I think it's a really important question. You have to ask yourself, who are going to be my first few followers, especially if you're driving a change initiative within an organization. And it's often a question that's so overlooked. I mean, the value of the first few followers, I think, is so undervalued. And as you said, the role of the leader may be over-glorified. I wonder how that will change as we start to look at leadership dynamics moving forward. But how did all of this start for you? I mean, I think you started out not as a business person, but as a musician.
Yeah, I still don't think of myself as a business person. That seems like kind of an accident. Really, I'm an American, as you can maybe tell from the accent. Grew up in California, and I really wanted to be a famous musician, or at least a very successful musician. And I think that mindset, wanting to be famous, put me into the mindset of almost like wanting to be an Olympic athlete, right? It meant that there are a million people that would love to be a famous musician, and if I'm going to be the one that's going to be successful, I need to be focused. I need to work really hard. I need to I need to have great communication skills. I need to have great discipline. I need to practice harder than everyone else. Like, it put me into a really healthy working mindset early on from my teenage years. And I devoured a lot of self-help books or self-improvement books, a lot of the old classics by Napoleon Hill and Dale Carnegie and Tony Robbins and Stephen Covey. I just devoured those because these were all the keys to my future success as a musician.
This was at what age were you reading these?
I think teenager, 16 through 22 or so.
It's so amazing that when you look at this stuff, you know, you know these are kind of motivational, and some people describe them as self-help books. But when you look at who are the people who are most motivated in society, these are the people who are consuming this kind of information. It's the same thing as, you know, when you go to the gym, you don't see a bunch of fat people there. You see these guys and girls ripped up with, you know, they're in fantastic shape, because it's not the people who need it. It's the people who want it that go for either it's the gym or that motivational book. And investing in getting motivated and focused is a very positive thing to do. And I always find that the most successful people, the most ambitious, the most driven, and most motivated people are the ones who are actually reading this stuff. So I don't know if you know Ken Norton, if you've ever heard of Ken Norton. He was a heavyweight boxer. He broke Muhammad Ali's jaw in one of the few fights Muhammad Ali ever lost. And he did it reading the exact same book you just mentioned, the Napoleon Hill Think and Grow Rich, using the quote, "It's not the man who, the strongest or fastest man who wins, it's the one who thinks he can who does." Amazing. Mm. Sorry, I cut you off, but so you're reading these books, and you had a focus early on.
It's funny, you know, I think about your listeners who have young kids that will someday be teenagers soon, that in hindsight, kind of doesn't matter what thing I was pursuing. You know, I imagine some parents would roll their eyes or be horrified if their teenager said they want to be a musician. But actually, I think applying yourself to anything teaches you skills to apply yourself to everything, right?
Absolutely.
It doesn't matter that I wanted to be a musician. I could have wanted to be a tree climber. I don't know. I could have wanted to be an architect.
The world's greatest tree climber.
Right. I was trying to think of the name of it. There's this sport in Australia where you run with a log, almost like a big ginormous pole jumping. You run with a big log, and then you put the log down in the sand, and then you have to climb up it really fast while the momentum from the movement. Anyway, I can't remember the name of that, but oh well. But it doesn't matter what you want to pursue in life. It's the learning how to pursue anything, how to be great at anything, teaches you how to be great at everything, I think. So after spending a fiercely focused 15 years of my life as a professional musician, I really was pretty successful as a musician, at least by my own definition. The last time I had a job was 1992. I quit my last job in 1992 and became a full-time musician. So I was living in New York City, making my full-time living just playing guitar on people's records or going on tour or producing people's albums or whatever it took to make a living as a musician. I was doing it, and I even bought a house with the money I made making music.
Wow.
And to me, I was living the dream, you know. Go ahead.
Well, this is the story of Derek Sivers and how he made millions with a guitar in his hand, or I don't even know if he plays a guitar, but he was a musician, and he's the founder of CD Baby, and as well, he's uncovering the secrets of being great at anything, whether it's music or whatever your profession may be. These are the secrets to success from Derek Sivers. Stay with us. Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are listening to the story of a man who set out life to be a professional musician. And while many people may starve at the table while they pursue this path, he actually became a multi-millionaire by following his heart and listening to his own inner voice, cutting his own path through the jungle, the concrete jungle of New York. This is a story of Derek Sivers. Derek, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Thanks, Shane.
And actually, I didn't mention, but you're the founder of CD Baby, an online website which sold, which still sells online music, I understand, which you sold for $22 million. The thing that really grabbed me, though, is that you gave the money away to charity. Is that true? Or
yeah,
did I read that somewhere? Let's just confirm that.
Funny, I know it's maybe a strange subject, and Dubai has this international reputation of being the place of billionaires, but to me, CD Baby was already making a net profit of about $4 million a year by the time I sold it, and I was the only owner. I had no investors, and so that $4 million a year went to me. And when I got to the point of selling the company, and we had an agreed-upon price of $22 million, of course, there's many months it takes between the agreed-upon price and the final, you know, wire transfer, that where it's all said and done. So I had a lot of time to sit and think about that, and I realized that I already had more than enough money. I had more than I would probably ever spend. You know, assuming I just invested conservatively into some boring mutual funds, it's going to kick off an interest of $500,000 a year. So what would I even do with $22 million? I realized I didn't even want it. So I was talking with my tax lawyer and told him that I was probably just going to give it all away anyway, and I'd like to put it into a charity. And so he actually told me about a really nice legal loophole. He said, if you're going to give it away anyway, instead of you receiving $22 million and then having to pay $7 million in taxes and then giving away 15, he said, you can actually legally give the company away now before you sell it, so that a charitable trust owns the company before the sale, and therefore the purchasing company will actually be purchasing it from the charitable trust. Therefore, that entire $22 million goes tax-free into charity. And so that's what I did.
That's
never even touched my hand. It was kind of nice.
That's amazing. Actually, well, you know, in our company, we run a search firm here, and that was actually one of our goals was for Vision 2020 was to create an endowment for charity. Then when I read what you were doing and your leadership stuff, I said, well, I have to chat to this guy. So maybe we can talk about, so you started life, you said you had a vision early on. How important is that? I mean, having a vision, having a focus, and being committed to that certain path in a success story?
Well, I think some people stumble into it eventually, right? You don't always need to have a burning passion and a drive. And in fact, I think that this word passion can be dangerous, because I get a lot of emails from people who say something like, I don't know what my passion is. I don't have any passion. I don't have any passions to follow. What do I do? But I think the problem is Romeo and Juliet. We think that love needs to look like Romeo and Juliet because we've heard this classic Shakespeare tale of the love-stricken teenagers that drink poison and throw themselves off of bridges or whatever they're doing in the name of love. If you think that love needs to look like Romeo and Juliet, you're going to be severely disappointed and probably even overlook what could be a great, long-lasting love relationship with someone, right? If you think that it has to look like Romeo and Juliet to be true love. And I think there's the same problem with this word passion, that a lot of people feel that they are not inspired enough because they don't have this passion. They don't have a burning desire that's making lightning bolts shoot out of their head. And they think, I don't have that. What am I going to do? But I think that real careers are built from just following your day-to-day interests. That if you find yourself tinkering with old Swiss watches, then you keep pursuing that. Eventually, you become one of the best Swiss watch repairmen in the world, and eventually you become one of the best Swiss watchmakers in the world because you were just following your daily passions. Following your daily interests creates a passion long-term. So I think you don't need that big vision up front. You don't need the lightning bolts and the burning thing we call passion. You just need to keep following what interests you, but it definitely helps to stick with one path and not be distracted, not be dabbling so you're doing a little bit of this for a while and then you quit, and you do a little bit of that for a while and then you quit, and you do a little bit of something else and you quit. as we know from any martial arts training classes, that's not the path to success. You do really need to have the patience and persistence to stick with something, because the greater rewards come slowly over time.
And I think the other catch here is that you invariably become passionate about something that you're good at. And so if you don't waver, you eventually get good at it and you become passionate about it, which is interesting.
I love that argument. You know, it was a year ago when the tiger mom, the woman in a Chinese American woman living in New York City, wrote this book called The Tiger Mom Something, and it got a lot of attention because she was saying that she's a strict disciplinarian and makes her kids learn three languages and practice the piano and violin for hours a day, and it doesn't matter if they say they don't want to, they have to do it. And a lot of people criticized her, but I felt that she had a point, because her point that most people didn't hear because it was more subtle was that the passion comes later because they're good at something, because she helped force them to stick to their practice schedule for a few years. Then they become good at things, and then their passion grows out of that. It's about, she was just trying to help them learn that. So it's such an important point that's not a very popular point to hear, because it's not shocking or newsworthy that patience is important.
And so as you went along your career, you started playing professional music. How did you start CD Baby, and what was the seed of it? You know, did you start it in your garage, or did you have millions of dollars of investment to kick it off? Or how did it start?
I think knowing me, you can guess which one.
Obviously.
It was just, I was making my living as a musician, doing whatever it takes to make a buck as a professional musician in New York City. And one of those things was selling my music. And this was 1997, and the internet was a different place. There was no PayPal. There was no Amazon. In fact, Amazon was just a bookstore at the time. And so if you were a musician wanting to sell your music online, there was literally not a single business anywhere on the internet that would sell your music for you. There were some big online record stores, but they were just a front end to the database of the major label distribution system. So they would sell Madonna and Miles Davis, but they wouldn't sell your CD if you were just an independent guy. So looking at that scenario and trying to get into these big online record stores and being rejected, I thought, oh, how hard could it be to just set up my own little shopping cart? So I really just literally set up a shopping cart on my website, which in 1997 was a lot harder than it is now. And it took me 3 months of work, but by the time I was done, my musician friends in New York City said, hey man, can you sell my CD through that thing? And so I was really just setting up a favor to help my friends and doing
just it for free. Hitting a market that the big guys were ignoring as well.
Right, exactly. You know, so imagine this scenario. It's almost hard to imagine now in 2014, right? But 2008 wasn't that long ago. And in 2008, if you were a musician in Toronto or Los Angeles or London or wherever, with a CD that you wanted to sell online, the only way to do it was a guy named Derek in New York that could do it for you. That was it. So it was a really lucky circumstance that I was the only guy out there kind of serving this untapped market. So it just snowballed and took off. Oh, funny, snowballed Dubai. That's funny.
Hey, we do have a ski hill here. I don't know if you know that, but...
Oh, good, good. But it grew faster than I ever expected. I really never meant for it to be a business. It was just supposed to be a little hobby of mine, but the demand just made it explode. It was huge. So it grew into the largest seller of independent music online with 250,000 musicians and 85 employees and a big pack-and-ship warehouse business, and it was a big deal. I did it for 10 years before I couldn't stand it anymore and walked away.
It's amazing. I mean, I was just interviewing the executive vice chairman of Dubai Duty Free, which, as we were talking about earlier, they have a sale of over $1.8 billion, their number one duty-free shop in the world. But when they started in 1983, it was basically like a used kitchen with a few like shacks in the corner, and it was just a mess. I mean, there wasn't really much there. It's unrecognizable from what it is today, and they had no gold to put in the shop in 5 hours. And the shop manager was Colm McLaughlin. He he goes out and gets $100,000 worth of gold within 5 hours from just jewelry stores around and said, look, just lend me this jewelry and get it done. But and how many people would have given up, right? You would have said, we're opening the shop in 12 hours. We don't have any gold. We're just not going to have gold for the first day. Or how many musicians would go to the store and say, look, you need to carry my album. And then they tell you to get lost. And they say, oh, man, I tried. But, you know, the man's got me down. The corporations won't let me in. And it's just not going to work out. Bury myself in this, you know, in whatever, and give up. Whereas, you know, the other people who persevere, who just say, you know, I have to get this out. I have to do this. And, you know, nothing's going to stop me. This is the story of Derek Sivers and how he made it to the top of his game, a self-made multimillionaire who gave most of his money away to charity, sharing his secrets to success. Stay with us as we get more insights on his ideas on leadership and business strategy. Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are hearing the story of Derek Sivers, the founder of CD Baby, an online website which went from not to over $100 million US dollars in revenue, and eventually sold the company for $22 million. He is a person who decided at an early age he was going to be a professional musician and has really made it to the top of his game. And heartwarmingly has also given the majority of his money away to charity, which is amazing. This is the story of Derek Sivers, and he's giving us his secrets to success. Derek, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thanks, Shane.
It's really interesting and career path you've had, and now of course you started out in Manhattan or New York, whatever, and now you're in New Zealand as we talk to you, and of course we're here in Dubai doing the call. It's an exciting world we live in today. But what really caught my attention is, you know, I spend a lot of time interviewing people and wrestling with the concept of, you know, what is leadership? What's the best leadership approach for various situations? And you have a very exciting mix of videos on YouTube and on your websites, I guess, which talk about, some very insightful ideas about what leadership is and how it works. Maybe you could give us a little bit of insight into what you think. I think as well, you don't consider yourself a business person, despite being hugely successful at it, which is quite amusing as well. But I almost think that maybe even doing your MBA almost ruins you because it gets you thinking about the wrong things. Whereas,
yes,
yeah, go ahead, please.
Exactly. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I believe that so strongly that being a, say, 22-year-old in New York City, having just moved there out of music school, and meeting a lot of people that were starting up companies, I would listen to them talking about their business. And they'd be talking about their Q3 revenue, we're doing our second round of Series A, blah, 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 and we got this. And I noticed they were saying nothing about their customers. They were just talking about their income and their organizational structure and their investors and something, and it's almost like they were just trying to make money by any means possible, and the customers weren't very considered in that equation. And we all know the feeling of feeling that too much as a customer, too, that there are some companies that we have to deal with, whether it's your phone company or whatever, where you can tell that there is no personal caring about you as a customer. There's almost this feeling of like, ah, what are you going to do? Switch companies? Good luck. You know, that kind of screw you kind of feeling that you get from a lot of companies that just are not making decisions based on what's best for the customer. They're making decisions based on what's best for the company. And just seeing this with fresh eyes after just getting out of school and moving to New York, it just felt so intuitively wrong. It just went against everything I had been learning about the psychology of business and how it works. That, let's face it, most of business is psychology. I mean, we're selling to other people. We're not selling to rocks or robots. We're selling to people, and it's the way that people part with their money or make decisions to even allocate their company's budget to something is through human psychology. So to appeal to that, it just made a lot more sense to ignore what the people around me were doing, no matter how successful or not they were, and just do what felt to be intuitively right. And I call it uncommon sense. It's not that original of a title, but that's what it feels like. That just, it feels like common sense that, weirdly enough, a lot of people are not following.
It's uncommon. So, yeah. Well, I think the other thing is that these guys, you know, and these people, as a lot of women now are also getting their MBAs, obviously. These people, what I call, they use the language of success. So they're talking with the words of finance, with the words of business, net present values, and IRRs, and you get wound up into this, and you almost get lost. You can't see the forest for the trees. And like you said, they're missing the main point. I mean, so many times I've been in boardroom meetings, and there's always a focus in any business on getting new customers. But the funniest thing that I think is hilarious is the person most likely to give you a transaction is a current customer. So why aren't you talking about them first? Why are you so focused on getting a new customer? Why don't you talk about what you can do for your current customers? And you're so right. That dialogue never happens.
Right. Let's look at an obvious example. Every growing business, or especially beginning businesses you talk to, let's talk just about people starting a new business. The main question I hear from everybody is, how can I get whatever, 1 million users, 1,000 users, 100,000 users to my new thing I'm building? How can I get a huge crowd like that? And I think, well, get one person. Stop thinking of them as a crowd. There's no such thing as a crowd. There are individuals, and there can be many of them, but they are just individuals. You can never get a crowd to sign up to your service. There is no such thing. So if you can get one person, get this guy named Jeff to sign up to your service and open up his wallet and pull out his credit card and type the 16 digits and pay you $19.95, whatever it may be, first just focus on Jeff and getting him to pay you for something. Then you can talk about your second user and getting Mary to open up her wallet and pay $19.95 for something. That makes a lot more sense, and it keeps you focused on what's real. It keeps you it keeps reminding you that it is individual people that you're trying to get to buy your product or use your service. It's not a crowd.
I love this idea too, because, you know, so often I'm dealing with professionals and they're saying, well, you know, my real dream is to be a baker. So I said, why don't you be a baker? Well, I need investment and I don't have the money and I can't do this. And I said, wait a second, you have a stove in your house, right? Why don't you just make some cookies, go down to the cafe and see if your cookies sell? You know, it takes nothing. And then they're just looking at me like, well, I can't do that. I mean, well, why can't you do that? I mean, start so small. Go out there and sell some cookies, sell whatever. I think that's how famous Amos Cookies actually started, right? That guy was an executive at Sony, and he would start his meetings by making his homemade cookies. And one day his friend said, why don't you just, you know, like quit and make your cookies full time? He did, obviously, huge success. But you don't, you know, start small. Do the smallest thing you possibly can towards your dream. And we actually just interviewed a girl by the name of Lenny Day, who runs a company called Smashing Cleaning Services here in Dubai. She came here as a Filipino maid, which is a very challenging profession. It's very low. It's a very low pay. It's hard to get out of that economic bracket. And in the evenings, she, you know, like cleaned her neighbor's villa. And then she cleaned two villas. And then she cleaned three villas. And then, like, you know, exactly like what you're saying. By the end of the month, she has like six customers. The second month, she has 12. By the end of the year, you know, pretty soon, you know, 10 years later, she's got a staff of 60 people. She's got corporate contracts for buildings. She's like, you know, one number one SME business in Dubai. She's, you know, a hero now. But it just starts small. It started with literally mopping that first floor. It was that simple.
I love that example, especially the go sell your cookies. It's so true, and it just applies to almost anything short of, say, starting an airline or something. But almost any business idea that people have, of course, they love to imagine that big end of the rainbow where this is going to be. This is going to be the next Facebook. This is going to be the next whatever. This is going to be huge. And they, you can start today with no investors, and no website, you can just begin right now. I think it's people almost don't want to hear that because it puts them on the spot. It puts the responsibility back on them and reality instead of the comforting thought that if just someday the fairy godfather is going to wave his magic wand and give you $1 million, then it'll all come true.
Right. And I, when I'm working with people, you know, I said, don't try to make a masterpiece the first time. I said, just try to make the worst possible thing you can just to get it going. And then, you know, if you change your mindset, because so many times when people are doing their first one of whatever it is, they spend months and months and months procrastinating and thinking and strategizing and just because they wanted it to be so good. The bottom line is, guess what? Your first one's not going to be that good. It just won't be. I mean, the first song you recorded, I'm sure it wasn't, masterpiece. Maybe it was. I don't know. But how do you approach, you know, getting started?
Well, if you don't mind me transitioning into talking about my newest thing, I'm doing these series of books that I call Wood Egg. That's just some random name I gave to it. But what it really is that when I moved to Singapore, I wanted to get to know my new neighborhood in Asia. That there were all these countries around me that I knew nothing about and I wanted to learn more about. So at first I was just traveling and backpacking and just looking at them and talking to people. But I just felt that that wasn't enough learning for me, that they say that the best way to learn something is to teach it. So I thought, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to publish 16 books per year about these 16 countries in Asia. And just like you said, I know that my first year's books will be terrible. They're going to be terrible, but they're going to exist. So I literally just went on to Elance and hired a bunch of business researchers and then hired 16 writers and 16 editors. And I didn't even really qualify them very much. I didn't care whether they were great or not. Just, here, let's just get it done. Let's get past that initial hump. Let's just make the first year happen, just to say that I did it. So then I can begin the annual improvement process. I can get past that paralysis of fear of launching. I can just admit to myself and everyone, first year's books will not be that great. Let's just do them anyway. And now I can begin the annual improvement process. Now, My theory is that the first year's books are not good. The second year's books are pretty good. The third year's books will be very good. And then by the fourth and fifth year, maybe they'll be great or maybe even amazing by then. But it'll take a few years to get there. So this is my second year doing it, and the books are pretty good now.
I like the one of my friends said to me, you know, you don't have to be great to start, but you have to start to be great. This is the story of Derek.
Nice.
It's a good one, huh? This is the story of Derek Sivers and how he made millions with his music and his secrets to success, his approach to leadership and his approach to business, what he calls uncommon sense. Stay with us. Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are listening to a story of a man who chose a difficult path. He decided to become a professional musician and worked his way up to the top to eventually run one of the top independent music websites, which was grossing over $100 million a year. He sold that for a handsome sum, but gave all the money away to charity. He's an amazing guy and what many people are calling a leadership guru at this time. However, he denies being a business person at all. His name is Derek Sivers, and this is his story. Derek, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thanks, Jane.
It's exciting being here. I mean, what a success you've had. And I think the last thing we were just chatting about was, you know, Get start something small. Don't have to go big, and don't try to create a masterpiece. Your masterpiece as you first jump out the door. In fact, in your most recent company, Wood Egg, you said, "Hey, I'm going to create some books. They're not going to be that great, but at least they'll get me moving, and then I'll start improving on those additions."
Yeah, I think that there's so many examples of this, and we mentioned earlier the idea of before you focus on getting a million customers to your new business, focus on getting just one, literally. And I think the other important thing is to talk to that one person then. I think that so many of my business successes with the company CD Baby came from the fact that I had this open phone policy, I guess you could call it, like an open door policy, but when the phone would ring, I would pick it up and say CD Baby. There was no elaborate voicemail system routing you to different departments. The whole point was to pick up the phone on the second ring and talk to people. And it's funny that over the years, I would speak at a lot of conferences and I would meet hundreds and hundreds of my clients. And the number one thing, after years and years of doing this, the most common reason people ever gave for why they used CD Baby as their distributor instead of all of the later there were many different competing companies, and they'd say, the reason I went with you guys is you pick up the phone. I can call you and talk to you. That is why I went with you, even though the other guys were offering more money or whatever else. That it's so important to talk to your customers and talk in open-ended questions, not, you know, Survey Monkey, right? And listen to the words they're using as they're telling you what they want. And remember to put things into their terms and describe things on your marketing, your copy, your words that you're used to describe what you're doing. Use the words that your customers are using to describe it. It's you get amazing insights from just talking to real people.
ION Careers now reveals the secrets to success.
If you're going to use as few words as possible, what would you say is your secret to success?
I think the one most important thing comes down to thinking of everything from the other person's point of view. It sounds so simple, but it's so rarely done for a company to actually organize everything about the processes around what's best for the customer. And again, you can say that you're doing that, but so few really do.
ION Careers, in association with LeMoon.com. Refresh your career with jobs, courses, and events.
I think that's so, you know, important. It's a cultural thing, and so many companies create a culture of business development. And what you're talking about, you know, what I would say is a culture of service delivery, of customer service.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That customer service is everything in a way. That, for example, as you're running a little business, there are constantly these things that will come up every week or sometimes even every day. You're going to have a new problem that you've never had before, where a customer is asking for something and wants a special exception done in their case because of whatever reason. And it was nice that we just made this policy of whatever the customer wants is fine. Let's just find a way to make it happen. So say we had already delivered the service that they paid for, and we did everything we said we would, and then for whatever reason, the customer decides that they're upset and nothing we're going to do is going to make them happy. They want their money back. And in fact, they want us to also, at our own expense, ship back everything that they sent to us or whatever. And I know that some other companies would feel defensive, or their paranoid survival fists would go up. But instead, we just made this policy of like, all right, you know what? If that's what they want, then let's just refund all of their money and we'll ship everything back at our expense and it's fine. Because you know what happens? It's very humanist to remind yourself that that person is going to walk away with a smile now. They're going to feel good about you, and they're going to tell other people, like, you know what? That company actually did the right thing. I felt that they messed up for whatever reason, but, you know, they refunded all of my money, and they sent my thing back. And they're going to go tell their musician friends what a great job we did. And it's funny how lots of our best customers used to be our worst customers. Sometimes the loudest complainers will become your loudest champions because that's just the personality type they are.
I love that. I totally believe in that, because those people are showing leadership, in fact. When they only 4% of your customers complain. So when they're that person, they're basically that personality that doesn't mind standing out in front of the herd and saying what they think, right? So if you can switch that person over, I totally agree with that. I love how you basically sum up your business philosophy as uncommon sense. What do you think are some of the biggest mistakes people make when they're managing their own careers? You know, when you look at it, and I think, you know, a couple of the big themes that I take out from your story is one is the focus. And I think from an early age, you decided, you know, I need to focus. I need to stay within the music industry. And I need to align all the information that I'm getting, the people I'm interacting with, and the places I'm going have to be aligned with that. And I think people sometimes lose focus. That can definitely be detrimental. The other, you know, subtext that I like picking up from our discussion and a lot of the work you're doing is that people really ignore the subconscious drivers or motivations. And so when you look at, you know, why am I doing something? Again, the guy who, for example, we use the baker example, who wants to have a bakery but refuses to make a batch of cookies to sell at the local coffee shop, probably doesn't want to be a baker that much. Versus when you look at the guys who wrote Wikipedia or who created Linux or any of these other things, you know, they are intrinsically motivated for whatever reason to write programming code. I'm not one of those guys, but there's apparently a lot of people out there who like to do that. You know, part of it, I think, is finding, getting, keeping that focus, going through those moments when you don't have that passion, and doing something that you are motivated or you have a driver to do, you know, to sit in there for hours and hours and record music and listen to music and play music is something you intrinsically like doing, whether you're making your 100 million or 22 million or however many millions, or you're making nothing, you're probably going to end up doing that anyway.
Yeah. I find it really, I love that you mentioned this at the end now, because I think it's really hard to separate the business and the personal, right? That in Singapore, I was a mentor at the local INSEAD business school, and I would go there, and students would show me their business plans and ask for my feedback. And they very often kind of show me this 22-page PowerPoint presentation of how their business is going to work, and they'd say, "So, what do you think?" And I'd have to say, "Well, it depends. I mean, who are you? Are you the Richard Branson type? Are you the famous Amos type, since you used that example? It depends on the person and what you want out of life. That some people want to live a happy, humble lifestyle with a little three-bedroom house and a wife and two kids, and they just want to be free and happy. Other people want to rule the world and be multi-billionaires. And no matter which path you choose, people are always going to tell you that you're wrong for choosing what you chose. You know, if you're not optimizing your business for maximum profit, you're going to get all the MBAs telling you that you're doing it wrong. And if you're not maximizing your time for maximum, I don't know, water skiing and lifestyle and relaxation, there are going to be the 4-hour work week people in the world telling you that you're doing it wrong and you're working too hard. And if maybe what you want is to leave a legacy, maybe you want to do it Donald Trump style and leave your name on buildings, and that's important to you, of course there are going to be people to tell you that you're doing it wrong, that you shouldn't do that. But I think you really need to know your own motivations and learn from experience how you work best and what makes you happiest, right? So it'll often be something that a lot of people will tell you you're wrong for doing. In my case, I've learned over the years that I love working alone. I'm a real introvert. I mean, I love people. As you can tell, we're having a great conversation. I'm a social guy. I'm not a navel-gazing mumbler, but I just thrive in solitude. I love just sitting alone in a room and working like that. I feel like I'm just filled with energy and could work forever if I'm alone in a room, especially in like a quiet, serene situation, right? But if you put even one other person in that room, I feel like it drains my energy and I get tired after 90 minutes. Or on the other hand, my wife is the opposite. She's a book editor, and she needs to have people around her. If she's alone in a room, she gets exhausted. And if there's any other people in the room, it gives her energy. She could work forever. So we all need to learn our personal preferences for what we want out of work how we want to work, and need to be honest about this and follow what works best for us, and not just think that because we read a business book by Ricardo Semler or Richard Branson or Tim Ferriss, that because that's what's best for them, we need to do that now. It's very tempting to fall into following other people's work habits, but you have to learn your own and be true to it.
Any last words of advice for our listeners?
Thanks, Shane. And actually, I do have one last goodbye to say, is that whoever made it this far into the interview, if you're listening and you're interested, please feel free to go to my site and send me an email and say hello. Yeah, my surname is Siverz, Siverz.org.
Thank you so much, Derek, and have a great evening, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jane.
That was Derek Siverz, the music man, a man who started CD Baby from scratch and sold it for $22 million. Thanks so much for listening to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips.